So good evening. As people continue to drift in and find their seats, I think we should get started. And it's my pleasure to welcome you. Thank you for coming this evening. My name is Peter Reed. I'm Senior Deputy Director for Curatorial Affairs here at MoMA. And it's a pleasure to welcome you here and engage in this program with you, which is called Conversations with Contemporary Artists, which is generally supported by the junior associates of the Museum of Modern Art. And if you've been following this program, perhaps you were here last week when Mark Dyan and Morgan Puett, Mildred Lane, and Alistair Gordon also spoke about their work in artist communities. And tonight we're going to continue that kind of discussion, but with the artists Andrea Zittel and Lisa Ann Auerbach. And we're going to talk, they will talk about their work involved in artist communities today and the relevance of that kind of practice in contemporary art today. Certainly the history of art has witnessed the birth of, you know, countless artist communities and movements that have coalesced to realize various artistic visions, perhaps through a political lens or a social or aesthetic or literary lens for that matter. And art movements today in communities perhaps are not necessarily the norm because so many artists are working quite independently in disparate geographic locations and with very different goals, of course. But there are still many diverse communities of creators that, when given the opportunity to come together in a variety of spaces to work towards a common goal, rather interesting things result. High desert test sites is one of those spaces that nurtures a new kind of artist community. And tonight we'll be hearing about high desert test sites and other alternative environments for making and experimenting with art. So let me introduce the artist tonight, Andrea Zittel, who will present with Lisa Ann Auerbach. Andrea invited Lisa to join her. So we have two artists from the West Coast here. One of them took the red eye, and thank you for your energy for joining us. And then after they speak for, say, half an hour or thereabouts, we'll engage in a conversation and then also open it up to you. The whole point of this evening is to sort of have the presentation as a catalyst for conversation, questions, exploration of ideas, and so forth. And we want this to be as informal as possible, even though the room is set up with this wonderful auditorium. But so we'll move from the podium to our lounge act over here and hope to have a really open conversation. So let me tell you a little bit about the artist tonight, Andrea Zittel. She lives and works in Los Angeles, but is also quite bicoastal and keeps a place here in New York as well. She's a visiting critic at Columbia University. But if she's not in New York, chances are she's in Los Angeles or Joshua Tree out in the desert.
Only Joshua Tree.
Only Joshua Tree. Okay, so I think of, I have to be, we have to be more precise, not Los Angeles, right? Okay. What's her background? In 1988, she received her BFA from the San Diego State University and then went on and got her MFA from RISD. And Zittel's art, which I'm sure you're probably very familiar with, but if you're not, it really crosses the boundaries of everyday life and art, turning some of the most routine tasks into artful experiments. So much of her work examines the kind of human need for order and kind of a close examination of things we do. Imagine when you wake up in the morning and then what happens and then you get dressed and then you eat and then and so forth. But this kind of close examination is quite compelling. And her one-woman organization, AZ Administrative Services, produces vehicles, furniture, clothing, food. All of these things become sites of investigation. And they're marked by a kind of apparent simplicity of design, but if you reflect on it, it's, and I hope that's what we'll do in our conversation, and as you reflect on this work, you realize it makes you think very hard about your own life, about your consumer life, about where you place values. The High Desert Test Sites, which is co-organized by Andrea Zittel, they're a series of experimental art sites located in the California desert, and they provide a venue for established and emerging artists to work. Zittel's an accomplished artist. She's been shown around the world in group and solo shows,
most recently a big one in Italy, but in the United States, Germany, Britain, and so forth. Now, Andreas invited her friend Lisa Ann Auerbach, who also lives and works in California. Lisa earned her BFA from the Rochester Institute of Technology, and in 1994 got her MFA from the Art Center College of Design in Pasadena. Lisa is a prolific writer. She's functioned in this capacity at High Desert Test Sites, publishing several key texts that accompany many of the projects that have been done there. But in addition to writing, Lisa's work is manifested through a variety of mediums, most notably knitting and photography. And in fact, she teaches photography at Pomona College. Now, in Auerbach's hands, the more traditional craft of knitting has become a tool for political messages. And when Lisa's standing here in the spotlight, you will see what I'm talking about. And her work addresses issues of urban transformation, environmental sustainability, community, home, the role of the individual in political landscapes, and so forth. Since 94, Auerbach has also participated in a number of international group and solo exhibitions. You may have seen recently at the Hammer Museum, Nine Lives, a wonderful exhibition in Los Angeles, and more close to home here in Philadelphia, the Tract House, a Darwin edition, which was a really interesting experiment dealing with documents and archives and so forth. So, enough. Please welcome Andreas Zittel and Lisa Ann Auerbach. Thank you.
Hi. It's going to take us a few minutes to get this all sorted out. I'm so nervous, I don't even know what my password is anymore. Sorry.
Is this on?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Hi.
Okay. Can you move this over?
Yeah.
Sorry. And then this is the thing?
Yeah.
I feel really loud.
I know.
Can I take it away from me?
You'll be fine.
Okay. Thanks so much for inviting us to speak and for your kind introduction. And thanks, Andrea, for inviting me to be your conversation partner this evening. And thanks, everyone, for coming out tonight. So when I was first asked to speak about artist communities in Los Angeles, my initial thought was that I knew nothing of the topic and that I was in no way qualified to talk about it. Because for me, the phrase artist community conjures up kind of a hippie kind of ideal, a commune full of people painting and having puppet shows and potlucks. But when I started thinking more about it, I realized that an artist community doesn't have to mean living together all the time, but instead it can refer to artists living in proximity, coming together from time to time, picking up where they left off. I think of it as a web of relationships that builds and grows and transforms. And I've been running into the same people at art events for 20 years, so I figured there's a lot of stability and maybe I do know something a little bit about community. But when I think about Los Angeles and artists living in Los Angeles, the first thing I think about is the city itself and the size of the city, the neighborhoods, how and where people meet. And for me, this is how the communities are shaped. Geography first, especially in such a sprawl, and then institutional structures that provide social structures. And when I say institutions, it can mean really almost anything. There's so many collectives and projects that sound and function like more traditional institutions, from the South Pass Supper Club, which was a super loose collection of bean eaters in the mid-1990s trying to find the cheapest way to cook, to the Richmond Institute, which is my friend's old shop, where we had plays, dinners, parties, and made work. Also more contemporary places, like this is Night Gallery, that is a brand new artist-run space in LA, in East LA, that's open only 3 days a week during the weekdays between 10 and 2 in the morning, and it's created a really giant following in just the few months it's been open. And the Llano del Rio project, which is named after a failed socialist utopian community outside of Los Angeles, and their mission is map making to create another Los Angeles. So this is the cliche of Los Angeles, which is that everyone's on the freeway, or that it's just a maze of freeways, and that everyone's on the freeway all the time, that it's this giant sprawl, that everyone is always in their cars with air conditioning blasting, sitting in traffic, singing along with Lady Gaga, miserable, disconnected. And of course, it can be like that, but it's a lot. It's something else, too. You still run into people walking down the street, and you still run into people driving next to you on the freeway. And yesterday, I was on my way to work, and I saw my friend Tad walking his dog right near the entrance to the 10. And he was just staring at his cell phone, walking his dog. And so I just texted him, good morning. And it was this kind of dangerous interaction. But it's really a small town in a big city. People talk about this all the time, but I thought I'd show a map. Maybe it would be useful that there are a lot of art schools in Los Angeles, and the entry into Los Angeles is usually or often through an art school, and they're all over the place. A lot of people come to LA to go to art school or to teach at art school, and it becomes a major structure within the art community, both professionally and socially, which in the art world is the same thing anyhow. So there's the UC schools, UCLA, UC Irvine, UC Riverside, and then there's all the Cal State schools, which I didn't even go down to San Diego, but this is basically the LA region, the state schools. And then you add in private schools like Otis Art Center and CalArts and USC. And then you add in community colleges and then other schools with art programs like Loyola Marymount, Chapman, Oxy. And so you can see there's a real density of the schools, and a lot of people are also adjunct faculty at many schools, and they refer to them as Rhodes Scholars because they're always on the road.
That's what I was thinking too while you were saying this, is that the difference between like LA and New York is really everyone teaches, and not so much for the money, but I think it's a social thing too. Like it's the way of fitting in somewhere. I mean, it's a kind of its own clique system.
So I thought I would do one kind of case study to talk about how these schools can be really interconnected. So I picked the most familiar case study that I could find, which is me. So this is me coming from Illinois because of a boy ending up at Art Center. And then that other arrow is like going to CalArts to play softball. And then there was also another boy at one point. And then leaving school and teaching at LACC and USC, then teaching at Otis, CalArts, CGU, and now Pomona, which I didn't even put on the map, which is weird. Then these are exhibitions or lectures. And then these cats represent former students or former classmates that end up in these different schools. So you start to see these webs grow between the institutions. And if you add other people to the mix, everybody has these similar webs. And so suddenly it just becomes this like huge, cozy community drawn out of the alienating sprawl. Okay. That's it. Well, I think I'll save that one. Okay. So everyone who comes to LA has a really similar experience. And on top of this regular kind of traditional schools, we also have a ton of do-it-yourself schools that are cropping up. There's the Mountain School, which began upstairs at a bar. The public school is in a basement. Machine Project is in a storefront in Echo Park that holds classes. Sundown Schoolhouse is in a dome. And now this is continuing Joshua Tree with Andrea's project, The New Everyday Life. Yeah. Did you want to say something? So I feel like everyone in LA is a student and everyone is also a teacher. And everyone's always eating. And for me, the idea that anyone can open a museum or that everyone is an authority has me thinking more about this idea of horizontal structure versus a vertical structure. And maybe you can draw some sort of opposition between New York and LA with this, that Los Angeles, everything is really horizontal, both the landscape and this kind of structure of authority or hierarchy or school. And in New York, maybe it's a bit more vertical. It doesn't seem like such a big deal in LA just to hang out your own shingle and come up with a grandiose or oblique sounding name or to proclaim yourself an authority on something.
Okay, so my trajectory was that I started, I'm from California, but I did grad school on the East Coast and I lived here for about 7 years before moving back to LA. And then, so that was true. I was commuting between LA and New York and Joshua Tree, but now I'm just in Joshua Tree. But in 1998, I moved back to LA, and Lisa was one of the few people I knew when I moved there, so she's kind of one of my first LA friends. And so I kind of fell into her community of people. And I remember being really struck when I first got there about how everyone I met was doing something. So this is Lisa's friend, Daniel Marlos, who was sewing quilts, growing tomatoes, baking cakes, and doing a column in one of her zines called What's That Bug, which I think is a website now.
Well, it not only is it a website, it's just been made into a book. So it's gone from being this kind of underground idea of bug identification for this zine that I did, and now he's become this huge authority on bugs on the internet.
Yeah.
Which is maybe disturbing, but...
And then Lisa was knitting, biking, hiking, and photographing people's half-eaten food. And Dan was building a huge sailboat out of steel in the middle of his studio. So it seemed like everyone I met, they were all, like, they had all these things that they did that were in these quasi-realms between being art practice, but not really. And I remember feeling really at home in this community because it was, I mean, just based on my own practice, I was so tied to this idea of doing things in the context of everyday life. And I was also thinking that when you were talking about artist schools as sort of an extension of the existing structure established by the real schools, I was thinking about the Museum of Jurassic Technology and how there's this whole kind of parallel practice of artists doing projects as museums or institutions. And I think a lot about the Museum of Jurassic Technology, how it was sort of the granddaddy of all these groups that have followed, like the Center for Land Use Interpretation, the Institute of Figuring, Farm Lab, the LA Urban Rangers, the Journal of Aesthetics and Protest.
Yeah, all of those places also have a CalArts connection, so it goes back to the school a bit. And it does seem like there's a lot of opportunity and possibility in Los Angeles. I think that maybe the general model in New York is that you leave school and enter the art institution world, whether working as an assistant or building crates, but there aren't that many kinds of jobs in Los Angeles. Of course, some people do that anyway. But when I graduated, I had a lot of various jobs, including this was my first job out of grad school, was in the darkroom at Griffith Observatory, which is a landmark observatory in LA.
What were you printing?
Like,
did you print stuff? Was it promotional, or were you actually printing like stars and stuff?
We were printing mostly pictures for the Griffith Observer, which was the official publication of Griffith Observatory, and then we were also making slides for Dr. Krupp's slideshows.
Oh.
Yeah. And I used to photograph paintings to be projected inside of the planetarium as
those big shows.
Landscapes, yeah. So then I went on to write for porn mags and art mags and also ski mags, and each of those communities really put the other ones into perspective, and I realized that there's really no reason to live all the time around artists and work around artists, and that the haziness of these borders and relationships is enriching to everybody. It also helped me to understand that the art world was just one more world, one world of many, each of which had their own star systems, conventions, and myopic understandings that their community was the only community that mattered. So this is a ski star, Glenn Plake. So skiers and
a porn star.
Yeah, so whatever, same thing. Work with their bodies. So skiers and porn stars had no idea who an artist like Paul McCarthy was, even if Paul McCarthy was skiing with them or hiring them. And artists and porn stars couldn't really care about this guy, Glenn Plake. The only crossover I'm talking about sort of the mid to late 90s, was porn. And skiers and artists both understood the importance of Ron Jeremy and Jenna Jameson. Skiers loved watching porn, and artists were titillated by the naughtiness. And porn also longed for mainstream acceptance. So for them, I was kind of this catch because I had this like mainstream thing going on at the same time as the porn thing.
What do you mean by mainstream?
Well, like I was writing for art magazines and ski magazines.
Right.
A lot of people were only writing for porn, and they were like, how do I get out? How do I be in a Hollywood movie? Or, you know, they thought it was like the entry into...
You were the ticket.
Not really. So having this role in three really different communities helped me to understand how important it is and was to have art reach a really wide audience, both inside and outside the traditional art worlds.
So I just wanted to point out, too, that a lot of your personal practice stemmed from this interest in the real-world communities. For instance, as your art, you made a zine called Casual Observer out of the darkroom log when you were working at the Griffith Observatory. So this was actually really great because they kept this log for the darkroom and Xerox, and it was super funny because Daniel, who I mentioned before, was also working there. And it was just, so you would Xerox the pages of the darkroom log and then...
I typed them up.
Oh, okay, you typed them up and peppered them with other stuff. But this was back, it seemed like it was very pre-digital too. They felt very homemade.
I made this on a PowerBook 100. It was the first Mac laptop.
And then even though you were writing for sort of mainstream ski magazines, you guys also did this magazine called Snowflake about skiing, although this one was like more produced. And you did Saddle Sore about riding your bike all over Los Angeles. And then you did American Homebody about staying at home all the time.
Yeah, I always thought it was important to make work about things that were closest to me because it just seemed the most honest route. I didn't get jobs with the intention of making art from the experiences, with the exception of porn, because it was during the time that a lot of artists were making work about porn, so I figured I'd get on the inside and see what was going on. And in the end, I didn't really make any work about that experience of working in the industry, but its influence is definitely in Saddle Sore and American Homebody in the photographs. And also, I got a lot of free stuff. And that was really good for gifts and bribes and barter and parties. So I recall your dog really enjoyed chewing on and playing fetch with this lifelike penis-shaped dildo.
And I wonder why our neighbors hated us.
It was during her raw period, so it made a lot of sense, but men really didn't enjoy seeing that dog.
Yeah, it freaked out my boyfriend because you came over with a bag of dildos for the dogs to chew on.
They make great dog toys.
Anyway, I don't know if you considered your reviews of porn art, but I do remember that you were writing for them the same time that you were reviewing shows for art magazines like Art Forum. And so since we're friends and since we seem to have all of these overlaps in our practices and our interest in real-world communities, I got you to start making the publications for our High Desert Test Site events, and they were zine style as an extension of your own practice. I was supposed to change the slide. So this is the cover of the first publication that we did for High Desert Test Sites.
So I thought that one of the reasons that High Desert Test Sites worked so well is that it brought all of these various communities together on an equal playing field. And with our lives as artists in the world, this is a balance we're really interested in and strive for. So my role at the beginning was to make the publication, and from the very beginning it was more than just about the art. So we had, this is at restaurant reviews, this is a page that has kind of local lore. Stories about the desert. We were really encouraging people to not just come to the desert to just see the art, but to really explore the community and the desert and the landscape. I saw it as an opportunity to take off the art blinders and expose people to things like tattoo shops and barber shops. High Desert Test Sites is in Joshua Tree, which is a rock climbing community and tourism, maybe?
Kind of everything.
But 29 Palms is right next door, and some of the sites are out there, and that's the largest marine base in the world. So there's a real disparate communities out there.
We didn't talk about put our demographic in here. We should talk about that later, unless you want to talk about it now. Should we?
Okay. Just pointed to the chair, sorry.
Okay, good. Okay, so I think it's my turn now. Okay, so I think there are several goals with High Desert Test Sites, but one thing that... Sorry, this is... Okay, one thing that you and I used to talk about a lot was how having an experience was sort of a secret artwork that re-embedded into the larger project. And now that we're starting to talk more about the High Desert Test Sites, I think it would be good to talk about some of the different motivations that actually drive this project. There were a bunch of reasons for moving to the desert, including the low cost of land, but I was also interested in trying to create a different viewing context for art. And one of the main practices with one of the main goals of both my own practice and High Desert Test Sites has been to find a way to put art into the world at large that integrates the site of conception, production, and reception of the work into the single location. One of my favorite artworks of all time is Robert Smithson's Buried Woodshed, which I think was kind of the original conception of site specificity. And now I think that the idea of site-specific has changed, and now it just means that art that's been retailored to whatever new location it gets put into. And then I also don't think that public art really is, Lisa says I should say public with a capital P. So public art with a capital P doesn't really function as an alternative to showing in galleries and museums for a bunch of reasons. But the entire idea of public means that you can't really do anything that might offend or hurt people in any way. And I think a lot of really good works are often complex. And sometimes I think they have a little bit of good and a little bit of evil in them. And then talking about the idea of public, the one thing that I never understood was why artists were always waiting for permission to put their work in front of an audience. There are literally hundreds of ways that you can put your work out into the world, so why are artists always waiting to be invited to be in shows? This is a project in Los Angeles by Landon Wiggs, who he also happens to be a High Desert Test Site artist, where he altered the text on an American Apparel Bench ad that was in front of LACMA. And the project was up for, it was up for 2 or 3 weeks before American Apparel even figured out. And then once they realized that he'd done that, that actually took down all of their ads in the area and they never put them back. So I think that we started High Desert Test Sites as a way to encourage people to put contemporary art into a living, breathing community and then to find out what happens. So this is an example. It's weird. This is kind of has been... Okay, if these change, there's something kind of weird going on with this. So Anne was doing a performance, and she wanted to do it at the Joshua Tree Saloon. And she asked the guys at the saloon if she could do it there, and they said no. So then she told them that it was her bachelorette party, and the name of her performance piece was it's cracked out, it's doing it again. That the name of her performance piece was called The Time Traveling Hooker. So the minute she told them it was a bachelorette party, it was totally fine. And so... she brought everyone in there, did her super crazy performance, swung around in the stripper pole, flashed her boobs, and everyone in there was fine, no problem, because it was a party and not an art performance. And then this is Feral Child did this performance called Dingo Derby out on Sunfair Dry Lake, and it was really great because they put up ads in the community and they got all these people from the local community to come out and wear their costumes, and they all learned this sort of big dance that they did. I have some more pictures of it. So it was really cool. We also, I got these, all these Burning Man people come out, too, because when they hear about it, they're like, oh, yeah, so you just like Burning Man. And that was. And then, do you want to talk about this? Oh, sorry, I'm there. Do you want to talk about that one?
This is a project I did, a unicycle shop out in the desert, and the unicycles were for rent for 10 cents an hour. And my first notion with this was to make something that would represent antisocial practice in an age of social practice, because you get hurt on unicycles, but it kind of backfired because everyone had a really good time. Although some people
I don't know
get
about
a little
it.
Hurt, but it wasn't terrible. I think that High Desert Test Site was a little bit about having people visit you in the desert, encouraging people to visit.
Yeah.
You had done the cocktail hours at AZ East, where people were invited to come and hang out one day a week in Brooklyn.
Thursday nights.
So in LA, we did pancake hikes, where we made pancakes at the top of the hill. And then you moved to the desert, and there weren't a lot of people around. So it was a great way to have a ton of visitors, all concentrated into one weekend. And then as soon as they left, you could get back to work.
Yeah, I mean, maybe. I know, you say that a lot, and I'm like, maybe. But I think part of the reason I moved out there actually was to be alone sometimes. And I also wanted people to come out and have a common mission that we could work towards, not just about socializing, which is often my problem with social practices. But that's okay, so originally we just couldn't get over how good everything looked in the desert, so we bought lots of land. And land was really cheap. When people come to visit me and I give them a tour, I like to go, oh, yeah, that 5-acre parcel over there, I got that for $2,500. And that was number 47. And number 08, this was my world domination plan. When I moved there, I figured out all the parcels around me and tracked down who owned them. And I've been trying to buy as many as anything that touches what I own, I'll buy. Parcel number 08, which is an amazing parcel, I got for $4,000. Number 32, where I was going to put the studio, but that's not happening now, was maybe $6,000. And then finally, 46, everything got expensive, and then I had to pay $30,000 for number 46, and now I'm kind of priced out. But with the recession, hopefully it will just keep going down. So, and these are just, these are some of the work, okay, it's cracked out again, sorry. Okay, so that's Sarah Vanderlip's piece on our, on a 10-acre parcel near A to Z West that's for, I use for other people. And Virginia Poundstone's sunken car dealership. And it's doing it again. Mark Claussen's piece. Oh, sorry. Is there any way to, does anyone know why this is sort of having a life of its own? Mark Claussen's piece on a 20-acre parcel that's, 20-acre North Joshua Tree. And then
okay.
Linda Tellman and Kathleen Johnson's piece on Andy Stillpass, who's a friend of ours who is also involved. One of the organizers bought a really stunning 100-acre parcel that we got to use. So that's their piece called Grotto on 100 Acres. And then Wade Guyton's piece also on Andy's 100 Acres. See, it's cracked up for you too, right? Okay. So so if you go forward to Jim's piece. So what I was saying is that the work looked really, really good. But what happened over time is that we found that the parcels just started to fill up. And then they started to look like sculpture parks, which was something we didn't want. And then the other problem we had is that work would get trashed by kids on dirt bikes, or, you know, the elements are really, really harsh out there. Or sometimes people would even steal them just to burn them for firewood. Austin Thomas did a carport that was, like, entirely picked apart piece by piece and carried away.
And this was stolen.
Oh, yeah. This is Jim Drain's giant gold nugget that sadly was lived there for about a year, and then finally somebody took it. So one thing that happened is... sorry, my computer is also doing the same thing, so I think they might be related. So what we realized ultimately is that I think we started to think about how art in the desert, it started to feel like we were kind of junking the desert up, and we started to gravitate toward more sort of ephemeral or performative or temporary pieces. So this is Hal McFeely's piece. I was going to show you this actually as another example of demolition. This was a good one. He did this out in the dry lake, and then a family of dirt bike riders basically took it out within hours of him putting it up. And so we would go out there throughout the weekend of the event and try and put it back together, and then it would fall apart again. But then if you go to the next slide, this is kind of the next. So this was a piece that worked kind of better in this context. This was called Dust Farming by David Dodge. And that was just a temporary piece out in the desert. And this was, wait, will it stop?
Yeah, okay. I just stopped it.
Awesome, thank you. This was Yashua Okon's piece. And he met this family at a local bar, and then he worked with them to create a constructed narrative the visitors would come, and they would go to this family's house out in the middle of the desert. The family would greet them. They give them offer them a white Russian. The piece was called White Russian. And then people would go inside, and it was actually everything that the family said had been kind of scripted, and it would rotate, I think, like on a 20-minute cycle. But people who were going in there didn't necessarily know that, and there's moments when it would get kind of confrontational and scary, and the guys would say, you have to get all your people out of here, and everybody would start to cringe, and then they'd all break into song and, like, sing halfway mm-hmm. through it. This is like, I felt like this was one of the gutsiest, best pieces that we ever had, because when he was telling me about it, I kept saying, oh no, it's going to be exploitative. I don't know, I'm scared, you can't do it. And then when it happened, it was amazing, and the family had a really good time, and, you know, they held up better than Yashua did, even though they were the ones performing the whole thing. And so I just wanted to talk about how it's really interesting to think about what sorts of roles contemporary art play once you get it out of the art world community. This is Rainer Ganahl's intervention on a billboard, and it was the Arabic word for oil. This is the Ford billboard that the local Ford dealership always put something up on. And it's also, we can go to the next slide, kind of significant to talk about, or to point out that the name HIDAS or test sites also refers to the Nevada test sites where a government tests nuclear bombs. So it's also a bit of a self-critique about what we were doing. I think everyone assumes that art always does some sort of good or moral or practical good, but I'm not so sure that it always does or has to. And this was the first piece that I ever chose for High Desert Test Sites. It's a piece by Chris Casper. It's kind of set it all.
Yeah, it was great to see it. Last week I was out there and it had moved somewhere else.
It's still
apologizing.
Yeah. So Lisa's often joked about how bad our maps are. They're not to scale, and they often have a few mistakes in the driving directions. Or sometimes the signs have blown down, or they get removed by the locals, which means that everyone gets lost when they try and visit the sites. And it's not really our goal to make bad maps, but when people come to the desert and they get lost or stuck in the sand, they usually end up making friends who come from who are totally different from the kinds of people who they'd normally hang out with in their normal everyday lives.
I think this is it's an example of actually a really good map, because the first map looked kind of like this, and there were no driving directions at all, just sort of stars where the spaces were. So it was a free event, and there were a lot of art students coming out from LA, and there were also artists living in the desert, and some of them would show up for the events too. And then there were always these art curious people who weren't artists but lived nearby, and I always thought they were the most interesting people. Andrea always seems to have a lot of wayward boys around her who sometimes work for her and sometimes are just hanging out. And I always thought it was really great to see these fancy New York gallery people out there in these big hats and sunglasses and tons of sunscreen pushing their rental cars out of the sand
and heels. Then
ending up at the bar. What?
In heels.
In heels, yeah. Ending up at the Palms Bar late at night talking to these guys. And it was a great way to connect with people out of your usual element. And there was a real effort made towards inclusivity. We always had the parties and events at public places so anyone could come. This was a High Desert Test Site publication cover by
Dave Hopkins. 21-year-old felon who worked for me in my studio.
It's based on the Slayer cover. Yeah. I don't know if you recognize that.
And then the next picture is of Virginia Poundstone, one of our artists, doing a photo op with Till Lux, who runs the local sign shop and helps us with all sorts of stuff. Like, he made our first signs, and he also designed these T-shirts for us. And then this is Marie Lorenz with Garth. Garth lives in this teepee way out in several hundred acre parcel, and he doesn't have any electricity, phone, or car. And then Garth let Marie make this sculpture around one of the huge boulders on his land. And then also working for free, I think it's really important to mention that we don't have any funding. So of course this means that many things are actually paid for by the artists and the organizers. The artists pay for their own work. Sean pays for our announcements and a really nice brunch for the artists. Andy and John have both paid to bring out really good artists from New York and beyond. I pay for porta potties, printing, and some other logistics like our headquarters tent and stuff like that. One thing I've struggled with is that we're sort of embarrassed because we're actually reading notes, but you can tell anyway, I'm sure. And so not only is this doing this, but my notes are doing the same thing. So I'm sure there's some relate. That's why I like pause. I'm like, oh, shit, where am I? Anyway, one thing I've struggled with is that originally we started out kind of as an alternative to institutions and galleries. I always saw our project as a kind of support structure for artists who wanted to put their own work out there into the world. And then when we got big, it started to feel like we were becoming just another institution, or like HDTS was some sort of show that artists would put on their resume.
The downside of getting big is getting big. And creating an accidental Woodstock or Burning Man is not sustainable. Logistically, so lately the events have been smaller with only one or two artists doing projects. From my end as a city dweller, I also saw that the most effective projects were specific to the desert environment, not just something like trucked out and put in, and they were formulated and embedded over time with a commitment to the particulars of that space.
So with that in mind, I took a year off actually to rethink the project, and now I feel like we've kind of worked out a lot of we've worked a lot of the kinks out, so it's feeling like it's on a really nice track right now. So with that in mind, we set up a permanent headquarters in downtown Joshua Tree where we can support long-term or ongoing projects. So people can come out here on the weekends to pick up driving maps or just to talk about whatever's going on that week. And we're also doing this new program called the New Everyday Life, and it's intended to be a sort of immersive experience based weekend for an intimate group of 12 participants, and it's kind of camouflaged under a pedagogical guise. This is Wells Pollock teaching leatherworking out of his school bus that he lives in North Joshua Tree. And this is Chantel Doyle talking about living out of her VW van for a year and selling stuff off of eBay that she bought at thrift shops along the way in order to support herself. And then we were just going to leave our mission statement up. So, well, I think we were doing some of the talk because we decided it would take way, way too long to read it. But I feel like this, we actually started with this, which is sort of interesting. And there's things that have worked out better than others, but I think that it still is pretty descriptive of what the project has aspired to be. Okay. Good.
Perfect.
Good.
So that was perfect and perfect timing. So let's move over here.
Okay.
And continue talking. This is great. Why don't I sit here?
Okay.
And you okay. Make yourselves comfortable. And we'll also, in a moment, open this up. Thank you very much. Great images, terrific images, very compelling stories. My head is spinning in many respects, and I'm trying to think where best to begin. But in the middle of the talk, maybe one place to begin is that, Andre, you said something about we should talk about the demographics.
Right.
And what's interesting to me about that, and you can just dive in and talk about what you were thinking about, is to take it back a little bit to this idea of community and the way you both observe people, environments, make connections, and establish a sense of community. What's interesting to me, and I see that you've got a mission statement, which I haven't read yet.
I know, sorry.
But embedded in there is a sort of sense of values, which is something you've thought a lot about, both of you, in your work. So tell us about the demographics. That is to say, how do you select your community, if you do? How much of it is just wide open? And it sounded like maybe there's tension in terms of other people in the desert.
Right. I mean, how we select our community for the project or?
Yeah. For the projects. And how much of is it open to?
Well, in terms of participants or audience. Because originally our idea was,
one of my questions is there an audience or is everybody a participant?
There's definitely an audience. Because remember in the beginning we wanted to make it like kind of open for everyone to participate, and we realized really early on that just became a total logistics nightmare. I mean, so by the second event, unfortunately, we were sort of having to limit, say, okay, this is it. But there's all these side events that happen as well that will help people promote.
I think that's when you became. There was an uncomfortable moment when, at the beginning, anyone who wanted to participate as an artist could do so. And then one year, it just was so huge, and so...
And bad?
Wait, okay.
It was so huge that the following year, there had to be a culling exercise. Yeah. And so then there was a moment, I remember, we were, looking through, folders and images and proposals, and we felt really terrible because now we're the judges and the curators, and that's what the whole thing was against.
It's true.
But so how, when you say you were flooded with ideas or proposals, how did you find these people? How did they find you? Or was it all, does it all go back to your friendships and the network that you were describing? You know, you've got your artist friends and you've been hanging out on Pancake Saturdays or whatever. How did you solicit?
By the second event, it was, the LA Times wrote us up. I mean, we were getting enough press and enough visibility that, everybody would come out and go, oh, this is cool, I want to do something too.
You had a bunch of students from New York too.
Usually if it's somebody we know ahead of time, it's pretty easy to predict what the project will be and to work with them to sort of say, well, watch out for this, or, I think it would be, in a way you can kind of tease it into something that's going to be interesting and connect with the community. The most difficult thing is when sort of somebody sends in a proposal from a couple states away and they have this idea of what the desert is and it's not that at all. So part of the goal has been to kind of to get people to come out to, like, sometimes people will come out as volunteers first and then kind of spend some time there and then, you know, sit, kind of propose a project.
There were a lot of Oasis projects, I remember.
Right.
It was like a whole genre.
A lot of people want to burn stuff too. And like fires are a huge deal out there. Like everybody's terrified of fires. So, you know, you can always tell somebody's not from the area if they send in a proposal saying they want to burn something or blow something up.
It doesn't.
But maybe it's the test site part of the name that makes them.
Maybe. I mean, I thought we should talk to a little bit about the audience, like backing up to the whole idea of like locals and artists, because that's something that we think about a lot and trying to keep a balance of kind of, you know, art world insiders and outsiders. And it's always super challenging to think about, you know, it's really like these two parallel art worlds and thinking about what are the differences and what are the similarities? Because there's an art world out there too. It's just, you know, we don't know who they are and they don't know who we are.
An art world out in the desert?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so there's many like parallel art worlds out there, and we think we're the only one, but we're totally not.
But 29 Palms is the city of murals, the oasis of murals or something. It's a huge mural.
There's Beverly Doolittle, and when I guess, who just built a multi-million-dollar house. So she's, you know, like there's a whole other art economy out there. Like when I moved there and I said I was an artist, everybody said, oh, do you know Beverly Doolittle? And I said, no. And they go, oh, you know, okay, well, someday, you know, they assumed I wasn't a real artist because I didn't know Beverly Doolittle.
So who, tell us more about the audience then and how this works in terms of it, because at first it sounds like it was a lot of your friends. It goes back to this idea of the party. You talked about a kind of sense of the experience being almost like a party, and some got small, some got big, it got too big.
Right, but then there were all these other people that started to come in too, like just regular people from the community. And like, the thing that's really good and interesting about being out there is that everybody, I think they always assume that you have the locals and you have the outsiders. And the thing about this community is it's such a crazy, diverse community. I mean, do we want to do the rundown of who's there?
Yes.
Like, you have the retirees who come out to Yucca Valley.
The Marines.
There's a whole New Age community. The climbing community. The ranchers with horses. The meth heads. It's a big meth economy out there. The desert artists. The contemporary artists. The architects. Have we missed anyone?
There are a lot of artists moving out there now. There seems to be a Vietnamese community.
Huh.
Is there? There's like an Asian community. There's a lot of restaurants.
Four.
No. I thought all the barbershops
and 29. Yeah, maybe. But the good thing about that, I guess, is that there's no insider and no outsider. Like, it's such a crazy mashup of people, and everybody's come there from somewhere else.
It's very transitional.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very transient as a community.
It's true.
Generally.
So
especially because of the base and the Marine base, and then all the services that spring up to service.
And the contractors who all come out for that, for that sort of building industry. So I feel like that really is beneficial for what we want to do because, you know, like, it's not really like an us and them situation ever. And there's so many different
people. It's not,
or it is? I don't think it is.
Even when the Bush billboard was destroyed?
But it's like I mean, I think that's just a difference of politics. Yeah. But then those same dirt bikers probably were the ones who David got to do, like, the dust farming piece, which I showed those pieces right after each other to show that, like, okay, they see a billboard of Bush and they're like, oh, yeah, let's take it out. But the minute somebody asks them to do it, like donuts as part of an art performance, they're all over it.
Yeah. But this gets quite specific in a sense, in a wonderful way, which is what I heard you describe was, in a way, multiple communities.
Right.
And if I think of community, I mean, one way to think about community is that the group has some shared sensibility, values. It could be anything. It could be you share land, you share religion, you share resources, you share, in that sense, community. And yet, you know, you're talking about a community, and you're also talking about communities. And I'm just really interested in what the work you're doing, how it's impacting or how people relate to it, how it might affect people. because it is experiential. You're asking people outside your immediate artist community, the ones that you've described, this demographic, you must be having some kind of impact on them. I mean, is there anything that you're, how do you see that affect or the transaction or in terms of that impact? Or do you have a desired impact?
I mean, I think there are individuals, certainly there are examples that you could take from individual experiences, like Till, I think, was very affected by the experience of having High Desert Tessite happening and becoming involved.
Tell us that story again.
Who Till Lux was really, the kid who designed the logo and the T-shirts and owns the sign shop in Pioneertown, or Joshua Tree.
He lives in Pioneertown, but the sign shop's in Yucca.
Okay. Yeah. So he seemed to be very changed by that experience.
For younger people, like people in their 20s, they don't know, a lot of them don't know what exists outside of there, or a lot of them come from military families, and so I think for them it's the most kind of maybe life-changing, because they see what their options are, like even with Dave Hopkins, who did the cover, I would take him and his friend, who they're working for me, into LA to see galleries and stuff, and then for a while, I rented a space for them to make their own gallery in. I think that they saw that they could transcend certain things through art, which I think was, it was really positive. It's also frustrating because they were, they were really hard to work with sometimes. I mean, I feel like I'd be painting a false picture if I said that it was all, like, easy and good. Like, it was very, very complicated sometimes working with them. Till was better because Till was sort of inherently a very sort of good human being. With the older people, I feel like it's almost more educational for us because it really helps me to re-examine, like, what art is. You know, I keep wondering, like, what's...
Well, you just anticipated, in a sense, my next question, which was when you said, it's like you have a weekend, and 2 days something happens, and then they leave, people leave, and it's like, you get your space back. And it's that I'm really interested in how you, because you probably both work quite individually and you need your personal time, and then you want the group time. And that my question was precisely this: how does the group activity, the things you observe, you're such observers of life, how is this impacting your own work now and your thinking? well, give us,
One thing, I kind of feel like it's almost like a think tank for a certain kind of art that I'm interested in. So it's always really interesting to see, how other artists approach the same scenario and to see what works and what doesn't work.
And is that scenario the site? Or
In terms of High Desert Test Site, it's maybe being in another place and meeting people that are not your normal community. I mean, in terms of my work, I kind of try really hard to go outside of the traditional art community to find other ideas or other ways of living or other models for communities or lives or strategies for living. And I think that's really important as an artist to not be shut in one specific idea of what an artist is, maybe, and to really kind of delve outside of that so that you have a subject for your work, and maybe at the most basic level to experience the world.
Exactly.
As opposed to other strategies of art making, maybe.
Well, art becomes so insular at a certain point, and it just becomes a sort of very myopic, like, bubble that you're in, and I think that getting out of it is so healthy for seeing art as well.
And in getting out of it, in getting out of that insularness, is it largely through this community, or is it through many other mechanisms? Is it through your teaching? Is it through the internet? Is it through?
I mean, for me, it's through many different ways and venues. I mean,
talk a little bit about that, just because it's interesting. It's you, as I was saying, you're sort of observers of life, and somehow, digesting that. And it's what I'm interested in is how you sort of, I'm going to call it do your research, which is maybe not the best word to use, but it's getting at how you see, how you think, and what turns you on in that way, or opens your eyes to say, oh, I want to think about these values, or about this material, or about this idea, or the politics. I mean, are you...
I think Lisa's much braver than I am, so I always see her going, like, sort of like finding something that's weird that fascinates you, like heavy metal, and like beelining for it and just devouring it and figuring it all out. And
I think I always sort of jump on opportunities to remove myself from my own life in a way. And I think the porn reviewing thing started kind of randomly. I called to ask this magazine a question, and they responded by offering me a job. And so I think those kinds of opportunities, when they crop up, you kind of have to jump on, because you don't know when you're going to be able to have experiences that are not on the path that you sort of carved out or you thought was carved out for you. So generally speaking, I feel like there are a lot of things happening within Los Angeles and around people I know, both in the art world and now in the bicycling world and other kinds of people that I know. And so,
do you remember the article like that Dave Hickey wrote? Maybe somebody will remember the name of it, but I thought it was so interesting, where he was talking about how artists were trying to get out of the art world. And then he was saying, well, like, we all went to school with people who weren't in the art world. And, you know, he was saying how you're surrounded by the non-art world to a certain point. And then I guess when you go into art school, that's when it stops. And so eventually all of the friends you have are artists. And, like, that's, you know, and at that point, then it's almost too late to get out of it. And I thought that was really interesting.
And are you finding HDTS to be a way to get out of it a little bit, and the bicycling to get out of that and to find the other?
Yeah.
I mean, I find that living in the desert is a way to get out of it. And, you know, also, like, I have a kid now, so I deal with, like, I have a whole extensive network of, like, community through that, and none of those people know anything about art or, you know, before dating, like, dating locals who, you know, so you get immersed in that community. But I think High Desert Test Sites is actually a way to pull those two communities together and to try and share that experience with other people. Because I can think of, like, I could just name artist after artist who have kind of forged relationships with locals, and I think it's really kind of blown their minds and sort of blown their understanding of what people, you know, who these people are. You know, they start out with kind of a simplistic expectation of who these people are, and as they get to know them better, and they kind of get co-involved in projects. Like when Chris James worked with that guy Dave, who was the bartender at the Palms, and he got him involved in his project, and then they just sort of, you know, it's just so interesting to see people. I think when you have a common mission, it's so different than just having a conversation.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Uh-huh. Do you, in your writing, Lisa, and, you know, if I know you're a photographer, writer, knitter, and so forth, how do you decide where to put your attention? And I mean, does the writing do one sort of thing for you, but the pictures do something? I mean, do you compartmentalize it, or is it all of a whole?
I mean, I'm so easily distracted, so I can't really pay attention to one thing all the time. That would be one answer. I think different ideas manifest themselves in different media differently. So that's definitely one of the ways that's decided, and mm-hmm. also venue, mm-hmm. what's appropriate for what kind of way to show the work. I don't know if that answers your question, sort of.
Yeah, I think so. But I'm interested, in how you know, if the writing is about inciting somebody, or is it reporting? Is it?
I mean, the writing exists in my practice in a lot of different ways. Yeah. There's the tract project where I was writing tracts. There's the kind of publications where there's this really sort of friendly, inviting tone.
Your sweaters.
Sweaters are another place that writing becomes important. So I think overall in my practice, there's this idea of getting the word out and proclaiming and declaring and things like that, and it can kind of go in long form or in very short form.
What kind of reactions do people have to it? In, again, it goes back to audience, in a sense,
in
or
terms
consumer, of
like,
your work, of the words, of the insight.
I think it depends. Like, I felt like the publications, people didn't really, I never got much feedback. And I would spend so much time dealing with, like,
I got your feedback.
The restaurant reviews.
Because you would do that, and then people would talk to me about them all year. Like, why didn't I give the Country Kitchen a good review?
I never heard it.
I know. It's because you would write them, but I would be out there.
Yeah.
So it's,
I would like to open this up to the audience. They've been very patient listening to all of this in this conversation, this dialogue. But usually in these events, people have comments, questions. You've all had a chance to read the mission statement. And I'm curious, without knowing precisely what's in it, it surely has sparked some ideas and curiosity. So I see microphones on either side. So please, let's open this up. I think you scared them.
Okay.
Here's one. Yeah. Oh, there, it's starting. Good.
How do you feel about speaking about your work here at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City?
She was going to throw up before the talk. And that, usually I'm nervous, so because you were so nervous. Can I?
Go.
How do you? Like, it's weird talk. We've never spoken about High Desert Test Sites before, and so much of it is just we've always just kind of, you know, winged it, or like, it's been such a weird sort of facile, quick thing that we're always flying by the seat of our pants. I thought it would be really good for us to have this opportunity to try and talk about it. But also, it's kind of nice to actually, I feel like it doesn't have that much visibility on the East Coast. So it was also really nice, you know, to be able to present it to people here.
Well, it's very local in that sense then, right? I mean, it's a real place. It's not, you can just ship it off to the gallery or a museum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or, you know, to how would you show it in Europe, you know?
Right. Well, yeah.
You can't.
It is. It's
it's experiential.
Yeah.
In the site.
Were
but
you invited, or did you ask to come?
They showed up this morning.
Yeah.
So we got to do something with them.
Right?
They were invited. Andrea's work is in the collection here.
We were invited under the context of artist communities, and then Lisa and I kept talking. We're like, I don't know, are we a community? I don't know, are we anti-artist communities? So,
well, they invited you to talk about communities, and they asked you to pick a conversation partner.
Yeah.
So you chose me, and I don't really know about communities, but I kind of live in one or many, so.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's so weird when she says that, because if I know of anybody who's sort of a community instigator, I think it's you. So, anyway.
It's basically, you started out with this free-flowing objective to kind of let the environment dictate essentially what happened there. But once you create a community, doesn't it have its own, don't you start dictating to it in a way and create sort of a narrative, force a narrative into it regarding it rather than letting it happen?
Well, I'm a little confused by the question in terms of the creating the community. Because
well, I mean, essentially, this community was supposed to be outside of what you were used to, so to speak. Is that
right?
And so, but once you start, you go somewhere else, don't you bring something of what you've already, you know, had to it? And then all of a sudden, it kind of negates what you're trying to do in some way.
Well, are you talking? I mean, there was that moment when I was talking about the crisis I had, where we were trying to be the opposite of what an institution was, and then I realized that we'd become another institution.
Right.
So, absolutely. I mean, that's been sort of a it's like this real meaty question that's in the middle of everything. That, you know, and I don't think you can stop doing the project because that comes up, but it's definitely something that we
And
can
what do you do to make that not happen?
Well,
that's a more interesting question.
Right, and what I was sort of explaining is one thing that happened was that it had become like a show. Like, the event was kind of like an art show. So now we're doing like smaller, the sort of weekends, the more experiential weekends. We're just, like, the original idea is that it'd be kind of like an agency that just promoted. Okay, here's the thing is that artists can make art anywhere, anytime, just for an audience. And so maybe the best thing that we can do, because I believe in that, the best thing we can do is just kind of promote them, like just help tell people about these art projects, because you don't we need money. You really don't need that much. All you need is an audience to exist. So we become sort of people saying, hey, check out this or check out that, or there's this person like, you know, 20 miles out doing this amazing thing. Go look at them. So just kind of becoming more of like an agency, kind of support, you know, support.
But you can't support everything. I mean, that's one of the issues that maybe she's bringing up as well, is that you can't, if you send out too many emails blasting about such and such and so, then suddenly it diffuses the message. So you still do have to become a curatorial.
Yeah, maybe that would happen. Like now I feel like there aren't, I'm always looking for stuff because there aren't too many things at all. But if there were a lot of things, you're absolutely right. So you're saying that then you would have to be kind of a selective process, and then again you would fall into that trap. No, it's totally true. That's going to be like.
I think the New Everyday Life project is really interesting because you're bringing traditionally non-art world people to teach various kinds of skills.
Well, the structure for it is it's 4 2-hour workshops over the course of a weekend, and 2 have to be taught by locals. And 2 by outsiders. So the idea is that the outside names will often attract people to sign up. But then, you know, we can sort of reveal someone local who's amazing, who they don't know about. And, you know, like you went to that and you met like Wells Pollock. Or, you know, like it's a really good way of introducing the outside world to people around there too, who they may never meet otherwise. And they probably wouldn't sign up for these workshops if it was just to be like local names.
How do you structure those? I mean, I would love to tell us a little more about them. You mentioned one, I think, which was the woman with the VW and then also the leather worker or something like that. But how do you develop those or find them and sort of root them out? Because again, you're kind of crossing these boundaries towards people who might not identify themselves as artists, but you're getting at something very human in a way.
Well, you can like meet somebody. Like I'm trying to do some on 2012 right now.
So tell us about that. Without giving away secrets, tell us how you're approaching it.
No, because it's just super organic. I just kind of ask everyone like, hey, do you know anyone who knows something about 2012 or survival skills? And then you just start a running list on a bunch of stickies on my desktop. And then when I see 4 things that work together, I'm like, yeah. You know, so I have all these like lists of different things that could be good together. And then once, you know, it'll catalyze at some point with the right person. And then you'll call everyone up and you're like, okay, I figured it out, let's make a date. But, you know, we're just starting this too, but I feel like we've kind of figured out a format that works really well. But it's curated, again. I don't know if that's a problem or not.
Curated or nurtured.
Yeah.
You know, which is different. It's a little different.
Yeah.
I saw other hands up a moment ago, so. Anyone else? Yes.
I had a question about your own artwork in the High Desert Test Sites events. Do you ever use your own work, or do you consider the whole thing your work?
No, I don't consider the whole thing my work, because I think that would feel really weird, like I was co-opting other artists into my work. I do use my own work in it. Often both of us are participating artists in it as well as organizers. Like my contribution, like a couple times I've done the wagon stations, which are a project that I developed that a lot of the artists will come and actually stay in the wagon stations and on my land. And then sometimes they'll be open to the public, or I did the regenerating field 1 year. So I'll have different like parts of my practice. And it's actually it's a great way to get people to see things in context. And then for you too.
Yeah, I started at the first High Desert Test Site. She asked me to do a project, and I said I'll do this publication, and because I was the only person besides Andrea who was in touch with everybody, then I sort of de facto became an organizer, kind of accidentally. But those publications were meant to be projects within the High Desert Test.
And you did the unicycle,
and the unicycle shop.
Yeah. And the small business postcards?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Andrea, this is also a question about your own artwork, and I'm curious, how has your work changed by being in the desert? And if it has, how so? And has it been influenced by having all these other artists working around you?
Oh, man. That's a lot of people ask that question. It's always a really hard one to answer because it's always changing all the time, no matter what. So, you know, and I thought that when I moved to the desert, it would become a lot more expansive and kind of freestyle. you know, freewheeling, and it hasn't necessarily, just because the constraints of living in the desert are equally difficult to those of living, or almost more difficult than living in an urban environment. So it's, you know, I can't make like these big sweeping sort of statements about how it's changed. It changes more from like people I meet or observations about, you know, the way that people feel comfortable or safe. Or, but I think that same process could happen anywhere.
Is there a change in materials that you become interested in? I mean, I think of some of your earlier work that is, I mean, the images for ranging from plywood to, you know, the
when I first moved out there, it was really difficult to get wood. Uh-huh. So I had to like bring it, like drive some so far away to get it, and I have a little truck, so I can't move that much of it at once. So I kind of gravitated away from plywood for the maybe first 7 years or so. And the hardest thing actually is just that my studio is in these shipping containers, so it's really, really hard to produce a body of work for a gallery in shipping containers because they're not big enough to work in. We're always working outside. There's a few people sitting in the back who hear me complain about it all the time. Anyway, and so, you know, like I'm working outside, and so everything, you know, I can't make a lot of sort of refined things right now because it would just get completely trashed by the elements. So, you know, there are a lot of limitations to work around. Just on a
practical
level.
So are you importing materials? Do you use found materials out there?
Or is I mean, for a while I just made all my work out of my junk mail because I figured that was my most plentiful natural resource. And so I started pulping paper and using the paper pulp.
Here we are.
Hi, this question's for you, Lisa. I'm curious about your relationship to photography and how it's sort of changed over time, going from like the darkroom setup we saw at the planetarium or whatever, and like moving into digital. And have you always used photography adjacent to words and in publications?
I started doing photography when I was really young, and I feel like it's the one medium that I feel like I'm, that I know how to use. In terms of the sweaters, they're made in Photoshop, so I consider them to be really closely related to photography. I use the knitting machine as sort of a printer in a way. So I think there's that really sort of pixel-to-stitch relationship that now has come up. I have been changing to digital photography recently, but pretty recently. I actually started knitting. I'm not very proactive in a lot of ways. So when I left graduate school and I lost darkroom access, I was doing a lot of color photos at the time, and I took up knitting to kind of fill the void because I no longer had access to a darkroom. And then when I worked at the observatory, I sort of fell back into black and white photography because I had a black and white darkroom, and now I'm in a situation where I don't have a color darkroom and I have some digital equipment. And so I think there's a lot of sort of finding my way because of logistical issues. Does that answer the question? Mm-hmm.
Do you like doing digital? Or is it, like, were you into the process of photography to sort of service the language, or was it?
I mean, I used photography in a lot of different ways. In the early work when I was doing zines and things, and it was a lot of sort of documentary photography or in the guise of documentary photography that would function in these kind of magazine spreads. The process, I don't love being in the darkroom, honestly. I kind of love the smell and the sound, but it makes me feel sick and get a stomach ache. So I have to wear a respirator, and that's not really fun. So digital is great because you don't get sick, but your eyes hurt. So, I mean, it's always kind of like...
Other comments, questions? Yes.
I know, it's weird.
Yeah, it's good. It's being...
I'm just curious how you knit with your hands. Because I've tried knitting with my hands, but it's just one long row.
She knits and I crochet. Because when I realized we had to keep separate territories because we're so similar otherwise. So I crochet. I'm like, can you knit in your fingers? I bet you could.
I don't.
Oh, no, you couldn't.
Vikings
you'd have
can.
All the So, you know, with crocheting, it's easy because, like, I did this with my fingers. Like, you you only need to go into one loop at a time. Does that make sense? Anyway.
I actually am a visual person. I don't, if you tell me, I probably won't process it.
Okay.
Quite right.
Yeah.
But anyway.
You could have a demonstration.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. You know.
We both have our yarn
right
there.
It's right here.
Yeah.
I have a workshop.
Yeah.
I'm going to sort of follow up on that, and I'm interested in the work both of you do, you with the sweaters, Lisa, and Andrea, you with the smocks, and the idea of making work for your body or on your body versus out in the world and how that's different or not.
I think for me it was about being, or a lot of it is about being out in the world, and there are a lot of reasons I started making sweaters. One of them was that I was on my bike all the time and I couldn't put a bumper sticker on my bicycle that anyone could read, and so I became my own bumper sticker.
It's interesting. You know, before when you were talking about photography too, I kept thinking that it's significant somehow that all of... So Lisa, a lot of her photographs that she's talking about are photographs of herself wearing her sweater. So there's this sort of weird, like your body completes that circuit for me, because you know, you have the garment, you have your body in it, your body's somehow taking the photograph and printing it and like making it, which I really like that. And it's funny because we've never spoken about this before, but I used to always think of clothes as like a form of public art. Like I did this drawing, you know, called Two Public Sculptures a long time ago, where I was wearing my dress standing next to the public sculpture I did in Central Park. So, you know, anyway.
Well, it's definitely a way to put the work out in the world in a very different place. I mean, you can't really have a show on an airplane, but yeah. You can wear your...
So tell us about the reactions you get with your bumper stickers. Does it provoke, or just
as I thought it might?
Hmm. I think it does. People just don't say anything.
Maybe.
I think there's always that moment when they read it and they're like, really? Because you make some really hardcore sweaters.
I think that there's something about the fact that they're sweaters which makes people not read them as much, or sometimes they read them.
Well, they won't read them for a while, and then after, like, there's, I think, that moment when they kind of work through it all. Because it's a little hard to read them, too.
But no one's responded in some way that...
You know, some people have responded, yeah. I mean, I remember I wore this sweater that said, "What's your favorite thing about the war on terror?" to Whole Foods, and I was ordering a sandwich, and the woman that I was ordering the sandwich from said, "Your sweater." And I was like, "What are you talking about, my sweater?" She goes, "Your sweater is my favorite thing about the war on terror."
That's great.
This is easy, actually. It's for Lisa. Could you just stand up and turn around? Because I noticed the back of your sweater before, and I think that that's a bigger statement.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Sorry.
Can you read it?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
What's it say?
It says, "We are all terrorists."
The front says, "We are all heroes." And the back says, "We are all terrorists."
Yeah. Do you have, are they up on your blog?
My sweaters?
Yeah.
Some of them are on my website.
Yeah.
In a section called Sweaters, Sweaters, Sweaters.
One more question. Here we go.
It's kind of hard to, it's not really a question, it's more of a conversation. It's kind of hard to talk about it in this forum, but I recently just moved back to New York from a very rural setting, and I'm finding a lot of crossover with what you're talking about the local population and that sort of thing. And I'm just sort of wondering, how do you... I've always thought of that kind of experience as like art is like a continuum. You know, there was, say, someone who, with his garden and his like local traditional techniques, like felt so much more like art to me at some level than what I might see in a Chelsea gallery. And I'm just wondering how, I don't know if there's like a definition that you probably don't have a definition, but how do you sort of talk about, or how do you sort of think about that continuum of like, do you feel like when you're in New York and you're at a gallery, like that's real art? Or do you feel like, you know, when I'm doing some kind of art intervention with my friends in the desert, that's my friends having a party? Or do you feel like it's all sort of on the same continuum? And I would also add to that, it's just a remark that two remarks. One is that it seems to me also really different from, I hate to bring this up and it's necessarily simplistic, but, you know, as opposed to like a man in his studio working on art, as opposed to kind of like women's ways of knowing and doing, you know, knitting around in a circle or cooking for people or doing, you know, sort of more community-based things. And I also kind of like the idea that when you put the art out there in the world, in the desert, that things happen to it. It seems like it's part of the, it's kind of part, you kind of give it up to the universe and it is what it is. Sorry, that's...
Do you want to respond really to this idea of art, life, and where are the boundaries? Mm-hmm. And
or the idea of
the fluidity.
Continuum, too, mm-hmm. right? Are you asking if there's a similarity between here and...
I mean, it must be something, like, what is... I mean,
Well, there's something...
At the most basic level, what is art? Like,
I mean, I think one of the things you brought up is just the idea of the market and what's the role of the market, because when I'm in a Chelsea art gallery, honestly, sometimes I feel like, you know, I'm in a store, whereas if I'm at an event or an artwork in a desert or something that's sort of outside of that structure of the capitalist art market, it's a really different kind of experience.
It's interesting because, I mean, that's, I hadn't even thought about the market. I think that's a really relevant comment. But, like, since I've moved to the desert and mm-hmm. become aware of these other art worlds, I've been kind of obsessed with trying to figure out if there's any common denominator between my art world and that art world or those art worlds. And, like when we talk about art, I feel like we probably need a lot more words for art. Like, you can't, and so, like, I'm kind of, like, doing this ongoing sort of practice of trying to figure out what the difference is. So, like, I finally figured out, I kept thinking, well, what's the difference between, like, these local artists and what we do? And I finally realized that a lot of the local artists in there, like the desert painters, for them, art is a form of self-expression, which is really interesting, because I think for us, art is a form of criticism. And I don't, you know, and so now trying to figure out, well, what are the relationship of those two things, and why to reconsider self-expression to be a bad thing? And why do they never even consider art to be a form of criticism? And then I think there's, so that's sort of two tracks. I think the third track is like the Burning Man, sort of more perform, like that kind of art, which I haven't quite been able to nail down what that is. I think it might be a form of entertainment, possibly. I mean, I feel like I need to go to Burning Man in order to nail it down or have a lot of talks with people. But I feel like it could be really, really interesting to actually be able to analyze these different art worlds and figure out what the primary motivating factors are between them, and then to see if there's any connection, and if not, to kind of, you know, try and put them into their place. And maybe I think it might be easier for everyone to coexist if we understood the differences, rather than trying to say everything's the same. Because, you know, maybe one thing we didn't get into, too, is that the only people that we have trouble with in the desert, the only people who are resistant at all to what we're doing are the local artists. Everyone else is down with it, entertained, amused, they have a good time, they're very accepting. And the local artists really, really get upset sometimes. And I think it's because everybody's trying to say that it's the same thing, and it's not, so it creates all this confusion. So, I mean, again, this goes back to my theory that actually creating divisions and creating definitions can sometimes kind of free everyone up to, you know, to say, okay, like it is, they are two different things. So they can do their thing and I'll do my thing, and that doesn't take anything away, you know.
Recognize the difference. That's a great question. I think that sort of sets a stage for round two someday that we're going to elaborate on it. And I hope we find your meditations on this, either on your blog, on your site, in your zines or whatever, because I think it really starts to put your finger on who you are, what you do, and how you're working in the desert. I want to thank you both very much, Andrea, Lisa, for taking time to come here, to fly across the country, spend an evening with us. Thank you. And I have a feeling you're going to have a lot of visitors to the desert before long. And thank my colleagues in the education department for putting this on. And thank you for coming.
Thank you.